Hello, this is Wayne Hussey of The Mission. I'm in Stockholm today with Fredrik Strager in his apartment, which has loads and loads of photographs on the wall and loads of books, loads of records, loads of CDs and loads of really, really cool stuff and a piano behind him. Do you play?
I don't.
So why is it here?
It's my ex-wife's grandmother's old piano.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Is it in tune?
It's completely out of tune.
Okay.
Some people like it, though.
Yeah, well, some people like to play out of tune, yes.
Thanks for a great concert last night.
You're welcome. I mean, we do our best, you know. we have another one tonight. As we were just talking before we started this, we'll be playing a very different set. We have 40-plus songs that we've rehearsed for this tour, which keeps it interesting for us, as well as for those people that come to see us more than once on the tour. We don't play the same set list twice. I'll try not to,
I remember when I started listening to The Mission in the late 80s, a lot of my friends kept talking about how great it was that if you went to a Mission concert, you would offer the audience wine, you know, pour wine through the front row. And a lot of them were underage, so that was like a big bonus.
Yeah,
when you went to see The Mission, because you got wine.
Yeah, we did a lot of things for the underage sometimes. It's best not to talk about. It wasn't just wine. We drank wine on stage, and the people in the front rows looked thirsty. You know, what are we going to do? Let them die of thirst. So, here, I have a drink. It's water these days, I hasten to add.
I kind of assumed that you were this connoisseur of wine and that you had really expensive taste. Then I read your two books, and the only wine you ever talk about is the godforsaken Riesling Blue Nun.
Yeah, well, that was the one that I... You got to remember that I was raised as a good Mormon boy, so I didn't start drinking till into my 20s, really. You know, when I started playing in bands and stuff, and it was like, oh, what's that taste like then? Oh, that's not so bad. Oh, I don't like that one. That's the red wines. That's too harsh. That's too strong for me. So the Blue Nun was an easy way to ease my way into alcoholism.
I used to mix Blue Nun with 7-Up.
All right. Well, you watered down Blue Nun.
No, with Blue Nun, it's been a bit of a punk wine, though. I remember reading that Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols had two bottles of Blue Nun before he went on the Bill Grundy show.
Yeah, I mean,
shocked the nation with his foul mouth.
Yeah, but Blue Nun was really not very strong. You know, two bottles, it might lead you to swearing, but that's about all. I mean, I doubt he needed much prompting to be outrageous. I was on TV, but by that point, I was on TV swearing at one point in England. But by that point, I was drinking Black Tower. I'd gone up in the world.
Oh God, that's an awful wine too.
Yes, they are awful wines. Occasionally, you know, somebody might come along to a show and I bought you a present, and it'll be a bottle of Blue Nun. It's like, don't drink that anymore.
But you don't drink red wine?
I do drink red wine. I have. This is the first tour where I've stopped drinking, actually. I started the tour drinking, but I got sick with a cold and it just wouldn't shift. And then it was like, you know what, I'm gonna try giving up drinking. And this was in Portugal like 3-4 weeks ago. And I haven't drank since, actually. The first few shows were weird. Because I was very self-conscious. It was, you know, because usually I would drink, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of a bottle of wine before I go on stage. And that's just to get me in the right frame of mind and relaxed and, you know, loose and stuff. But going on stage sober was actually always quite terrifying. I had to do it once or twice when I was sick and on antibiotics. And it's terrifying. And when I stopped on this tour, the first... I don't know, two or three shows, it was really quite intimidating going on and not being in that state. And I felt very self-conscious. But after about three songs, it kind of, you know, you kind of get into the persona, inverted commas, of being on stage, you know. And I've actually quite enjoying the shows now. Not that I didn't enjoy the shows before, but... you know, the emphasis for me now is on performance and being able to sing properly and being able to play the songs properly, you know, rather than stumble through them.
Will you keep being sober, you know, for the rest of your life, or is this just a tour thing?
No. I would have a drink if I went out for a dinner with you tonight for, well, not tonight because I've got a show, but if I went out for a dinner with you on a night off, I'd have a drink. I'm not teetotal. I'm not going the whole hog, you know. I will drink when I'm at home.
You've always been very generous to your audience.
I think they've always been very generous to us, so it's a reciprocal thing.
At one point, you played in Orange County, and you were unhappy with the sound during the concert. And then you told the audience that, you know, if any of you guys want to be on the guest list tomorrow when we'll play in LA, you're welcome. And then you put 200 people on the guest list, which financially might be stupid. But I was just thinking that if you do things like that, you know, those people will probably listen to you for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, well, the practicality of that situation in particular was, yeah, we played in Orange County. It was rubbish. I don't know, can't remember why it was rubbish. It was a small club. Maybe it sounded terrible. We didn't play well. I don't know. But yes, I said, anybody wants to be on the guest list for tomorrow? We're in LA at the Palace. The thing was, the LA Palace, I think, is like, I don't know, 1,500 people capacity. It'd been sold out for weeks. We had a huge guest list. K-Rock was, you know, featuring it all and everything, you know, and then we had 200 extra people turn up, and it was a bit chaotic, shall we say. But it was also the show, we played a lunchtime show for K-Rock the next morning, which was a bit fraught. And then things escalated during the afternoon, and we ended up having to cancel that show at night because Craig decided he wanted to leave the band. He was, you know, and he wanted to go home, so he flew home that night. So we had to cancel that show. So those 200 people might have travelled all the way from Orange County to LA for nothing.
Oh, sad.
Well, no, you know, they would have been there witnessing the chaos at the LA Palace. Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, not a soul is there. This is Starman by David Bowie and Spiders from Mars from the Ziggy Stardust album. My first big love in music was the Beatles and then Bolan. But then Bowie came along about 6 months after I got into Bolan and became the bigger love, I suppose you would say. What can you say about him? Influence on so many levels to so many people. And this was his first hit.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I read that J.K. Rowling went to the same school as you.
Yeah, she did. Same junior school. I mean,
she's a bit younger than you, though.
Yeah, I'm like 2 or 3 years older than her. But when she was, I don't know, when she was between 5 and 8, something like that, she was at the same school as me. And back in those days, most kids that were short-sighted didn't wear glasses. It wasn't diagnosed. But I remember not being able to see the blackboard very clearly, and the teacher said, Wayne's adding up his sums wrong, so maybe he's got a problem with vision. So they told my parents, and my mum took me to the opticians, and yes, I needed glasses, so I was the only kid in school wearing glasses. So I was like, you know, I looked like that geeky little kid. And if you see photographs of me when I was young, it's the spitting image of Harry Potter. So I'm not claiming that I was the inspiration, but maybe, you know, when she writes these characters, that she pictures people from her past, and I may well have been one of the little nerdy kids that she based Harry Potter on. In fact, the character of Dumbledore, not that I know much about Harry Potter, but the character of Dumbledore was definitely based on our headmaster at that school, Mr. Alfred Dunn. So, who knows?
Also, later in life, you were rumored to be involved in dark, secret, occult rituals.
Was I?
Magic, like Harry Potter.
Yeah, no, was I? I don't know. Was I rumored? Maybe. Maybe I was rumored. I mean, my fascination with that was fleeting, and it was largely born out of being a huge Jimmy Page fan. But I did read, you know, I did read Aleister Crowley for a bit, and, you know, and... how can I say? Enjoyed the company of people that were into it.
You were raised a Mormon.
Mm.
How strict were your parents?
They weren't strict, but, you know, we as a family, I was the eldest of 5, so I had to set the example. But yeah, we went to church regularly, you know, most evenings of the week were actually spent one or more of us at the church, you know, with various activities and things. And I wouldn't say they were strict, but they adhered to the precepts of the church and raised us in that way. You know, and I've always contended that, you know, to find your own middle ground, you have to go from one extreme to the other. So, you know, whilst I led that childhood where, you know, I was... It's not deprived, but repressed, maybe. When I got to my 20s and, you know, I was started playing in bands and stuff, I went completely the opposite extreme. And so, and kind of, you know, now I'm kind of in the middle.
Did you see the musical The Book of Mormon?
Nope.
Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who wrote it, described it as an atheist love letter to religion.
Right.
And they'd said in a lot of interviews that they grew up with lots of Mormon friends. And they all had one thing in common. They were super nice. Their families, all the children.
Well, that is one thing that I will actually say. And I would imagine that there's a lot of religions that are similar. But the emphasis in Mormonism was on the family, was on family unity. And we would have one evening a week where the family would all be together and we would all have an activity. And you weren't allowed to go out and play with your mates or, you know, go and do other things. And I would say I am still very close to my mother and father. God bless them. They're still alive. I'm still very active in the church. They even went to serve a mission in their early 70s in the Philippines. You know, so they went away for 18 months at their own expense to do a Mormon mission, which is incredible. You know, I mean, they have a lot of energy, my parents, and they do a lot of good work with the church and through the church and within the community. So, I'm we're close. You know, I'm close with my brothers and sisters and they're close with my mother and father. Yeah, it's great. I mean, on that side of things, that was a very, very, very good thing to grow up with.
Did they expect you to go on a mission yourself?
Well, I am.
Well, of course, you're in the mission. But I mean, did they
yes,
want
they
to
did.
Send you off to, like, Uganda? like the Book of Mormon.
Well, I don't know if I would have got sent to Uganda because you have to. And they tend to send you to a place where, you know, if you can speak a language, they tend to speak. Send you there. So I probably would have got sent to Leeds or somewhere like that. Yeah, they did want me to go on a mission. And there was one time, you know, in my mid-teens when I seriously considered it. But then Mark Boland came along and watched him on Top of the Pops, and I thought, you know what? That's what I want to do. That's the kind of mission I want in life, and that's a good cue for get it on. I've had all sorts of guitars in all kinds of pedals in all kinds of amplifiers, but that guitar sound at the beginning of that is so sexual to me, and I've never been able to and it's so simple to play, but just to recreate that particular sound is like a bit impossible.
In some of the reviews that have been published of your two books, Salad Days and Heated Days, they mention that you write about guitars in a very sexual and sensual way, whereas sex is more, you know, funny anecdotes.
well, sex can be really funny. But guitars, I think, guitars are the... No disrespect to my wife. I love my wife dearly, and she is the love of my life. But guitars have been in my life a lot longer than she has. And they've been, ever since I was a teenager, they've been ever present. And they have been the thing that have sustained me creatively, spiritually. Times when I've been low, you know, you pick up a guitar and you play guitar, and that can, you know, shift your mood. It's the same with the piano. I love playing the piano too. And it's just playing for playing's sake, not for any specific purpose, not to write a song, not to make, you know, music for anybody else, just to play. And there's a lot, you know, I found a lot of solace in playing over the years at times that I've needed just to, you know, chill and be with myself. Yeah, I mean, guitars are sexual. You know, the guitars, you hug them, you pull them into your body, you know, you move them around. It's they're rubbing up against your groin, you know, for one. And they're sexual.
That's a very cock rockish statement, isn't it?
Well, it's well, you're calling me a cock. Well, that's the first to be called the cock to my face. Yes, maybe it is, but it is a physical thing. You know, it's a physical thing. But the piano has a slightly different feel because as you're playing it, in a way, you're actually pushing it away from you. You know, with the keys, you know, it's not something you embrace. The guitar you embrace, you know, you pull it into your body. The piano you push away. So I don't know. I mean, I love playing them both. So I guess, I like a bit of push and pull.
One of the first groups that you played the guitar in was Dead or Alive. And their lead singer, Pete Burns, wrote in his autobiography, Freak Unique, that you were fabulously talented.
Well, he's right.
He also wrote, he was a Mormon then, adhering very strictly to the Mormon religion, but he was such a lovely person. I loved Wayne. What was it like to be a young, sexually repressed Mormon and play in a band with a super decadent diva like Pete Burns?
Well, it was an education, you know. I mean, that he was very different. It was definitely instrumental and part of the process of me of going from one extreme to the other. I love Pete. I mean, loved being in Dead or Alive. It was definitely a gang of people that really cared about each other until he didn't care about you. And then he could be right, bitch. One must be ill of the dead. But I loved being in Dead or Alive. We only played six shows in the 2 years I was in the band, but we were a gang. We would go out together at weekends. We started going to gay clubs because they were safer than normal rock clubs for the way that we looked. And I mean, Pete was gay. Even though he's married, he was gay. So we also started listening to a lot of gay, what you would call gay music, disco music, dance music, at a time when we were still a guitar-based band. And so that ultimately started to have an influence on the music we made together. But Pete, he was lovely. I mean, he was generous. He was funny. He was a bitch. He could be a nasty bugger. But if he was on your side, he would fight for you. You know, he would really stick up for you. He was a good person to be friends with, but not to be enemies with.
And you kind of introduced the synthesizers in Dead or Alive, thereby, putting yourself out of a job.
Yeah, ultimately I did. Yeah, but it's fine though, because I was young and I was experimenting with guitars, you know, as you do when you want to see what they can do and what you can do with them. And I was living with a guy who was in a synth band, and he had a drum machine. I can't remember which one now, but it was really in the days of infancy of MIDI. And he had a drum machine that you could plug into the MIDI of a synthesizer. And he had a Roland SH-101, I think it was called, SH-01, one of those. It was a little keyboard. And then on the back, it had an input for a CV gate. Now, if anybody doesn't know what that means, it does not important. But what I found out was if I could plug my guitar into that CV gate, the drum machine would trigger the synthesizer, and I could play the guitar, and the guitar would go digga 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 in time with the drum machine. And that revolutionized what we were doing in Dead or Alive at that time. I remember taking it into the rehearsals, and Pete said, right, we're doing everything on with this now. Everything, we're going to get rid of the drummer and we're going to do every song with this. And in the end, we ended up signing to what was CBS at the time, who are now part of Sony, I believe. And when we signed the deal, we bought an Oberheim system, which was a drum machine, a MIDI sequencer and a synth, and which was state of the art at the time. And you could sync all of those up together and they would play together. It's what New Order did Blue Monday with. And a lot of the programming on that was actually the preset patterns that came with the drum machine, but they just kind of beautifully patched it all together and made one of the most outstanding records of the 80s, you know, in Blue Monday. I'm not playing that one, by the way, but that, never mind. So when we started to make the album, I would come up with guitar lines, and Pete thought it would be better if we programmed what I was playing on the guitar on the keyboard into a sequencer. So, because you have kind of more flexibility over the sound. You can make it sound like, I don't know, you know, a synthesizer or another sound rather than just a guitar going dugga, dugga, dugga. So in the end, yeah, I mean, I kind of did myself out of a job, but I was ready for a change. You know, I'm a guitar player. I was a guitar player. I was an ambitious young man. I wanted to play guitar. I didn't want to go dugga, dugga, dugga all the time. And so during the course of that album, it was decided I would leave. So I left.
And before leaving, you co-wrote You Spin Me Round Like a Record.
I didn't co-wrote that, no. That came afterwards, but I did co-wrote the song they put on the B-side, Misty Circles, which in those days, the publishing was split equally between the A and B-side. So that actually, when You Spin Me went to number one all around the world, actually brought me in a lot of, a lot of money. It brought me in enough money to help pay for the first two Mission singles, which we self-financed and released independently.
But before that, you were in the Sisters of Mercy for a while.
Before the Mission.
Before the Mission, of course. Yeah, and yeah. After Dead or Alive.
I don't know if you remember Pauline Murray in The Invisible Girls. Pauline Murray used to be...
That was kind of your first band.
Yeah, and that was my first European tour. It was weird. We played in Oslo the other night. And that's the first time I played in Oslo in 23 years, I think. But my first ever show outside of the UK as a young musician was in Oslo, which was 1981, and I was the youngest on the tour. And then we turned up, you know, a couple of days ago into Oslo, and now I'm the eldest on the tour. And then, of course, then from 1981 on tour with Pauline Murray, you know, it's led to a life of excess and rock and roll. Here we go, Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin.
When you joined the Sisters of Mercy, what was your first impression of Andrew Eldritch? I know you mentioned somewhere that he felt kind of intellectually superior, that he was very well read.
Yeah, it was. He'd gone to university. He came from a family that I think it was military. I think his background. I won't be 100% sure because he never spoke about his family background. He never, to my knowledge, never visited. And I know he. I remember one night being sat there in the living room with him, and the telephone. He wouldn't answer the telephone, so he asked me to answer the telephone. And it's like, hello, and he said, "Is Andrew there, please? This is his mother," and it's like, "It's your mum. Tell her I'm not here." It's like, okay. So my first impressions of Andrew is that he, as a human being, for whatever reason, there's not a lot of warmth in him. But that was never an issue. You know, you're working together, and sometimes those tensions between you actually create great art. And I think with First and Last and Always, when we did that album, there was an awful lot of tension in the band. And I think I came along at a time, and in a way I held that band together for as long as I could, you know, because Gary Marks and Andrew weren't talking pretty much from day one. Craig became my mate, my ally, and in a way we ended up being the mouthpieces in conversation between Andrew and Gary Marks, and it was a strange situation, but I've been in strange situations and strange dynamics in bands before, so it didn't seem any particularly unusual, you know. And bands function with all kinds of different dynamics.
Did he hesitate before letting you write songs for the group?
He encouraged me to write. Yeah, he went as soon as I would join the band. He was encouraged me to write tunes for the band, and I mean, the first tune I wrote ended up being Body and Soul, that was kind of like Sisters by Numbers, really, to be totally frank with you. I mean, it was like, okay, I'm in this new band, they sound like this, I'll write this song. We ended up using that as the next single, actually, after, because I joined just before Temple of Love came out, and then so Body and Soul was the next single after that. On a professional level, we didn't actually spend a lot of time in the studio together, me and Andrew. I mean, he would like to work at night. I would tend to work during the day. I mean, you know, you're paying for studio times. It's expensive. So we weren't in a position where we could be excessive. So we maximized our time in the studio. And so, as I said, Andrew would generally work at night and I would work during the day. And Craig would generally work during the day. I can't remember Gary Marks actually being in the studio very much during the recording of First and Last Noise, but he must have been there at some points. And, you know, the album took a lot longer to make than it was intended to. Andrew got ill, mainly because he would stay. He refused to sleep in the boarding house, the hotel we were staying in, and slept in a cupboard in the studio. I mean, he didn't see daylight for weeks, Andrew. He just would not see daylight, you know. And so, I mean,
why on earth would he do that? Was he building some kind of image, or was he an actual vampire?
No, he's not an actual vampire. But I don't think it's a building of image. I think it's maybe starting to believe the image. You know, I mean, Craig has told me before when he joined the band, which was a few years earlier, Andrew Taylor, you know, he was this geeky university student, you know, who had this idea of forming a band with Gary Marks, and Gary Marks and Andrew formed the band, and Craig came in a little bit later. And at that point, Andrew Taylor was this guy that went to university, studied Chinese, and I mean, he is an intellectual. There is no doubt, and he's an intellectual. He's educated, and he has, fierce intellect. It's a bugger to argue with. You never win an argument with Andrew. And
you seem to be like polar opposites, especially now. You know, when I read your books, I was.
Well, I think
was that you've really enjoyed yourself.
Yeah,
for decades. While if you go to see the Sisters of Mercy now, he doesn't seem to have a very good time. He's standing all the way in the back. His voice is gone.
I don't really know. I haven't seen them for a while. And you know, when people tell me, "Oh, they're rubbish now," I kind of temper that with the idea that maybe they're saying that because they think that's what I want to hear. You know, I don't wish the man any ill. I wish, you know, I mean, we're both here still doing what we do, and we're lucky. We're fortunate. We've managed to come through what's 40 years since we split up. I first got together, Sisters of Mercy, when I first joined the Sisters. So, you know, you can't harbour those resentments for that long, you know, otherwise it poisons you. You know, and I mean, just think of yourself, you know, if somebody you worked with, you know, 20, 30 years ago, do you keep in touch with them? Mostly not, no. It's the same with me and Andrew. It's fine. And he does what he does. I've heard he's not particularly well, but then, you know, we're all getting to the age where we're not particularly well. Although, you know, I'm 65 in less than a week now. But Phil, I mean, with Touchwood, I feel okay.
He did harbor some kind of resentment when he wrote this Corrosion. The first Sisters of Mercy single after you left.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which was said to be some kind of parody of your songwriting.
Yeah. But you know what was funny? When we were still in the band and we were actually talking and writing about songs for the second album, I went to Hamburg and stayed with him for a couple of weeks, and we were working on... I had a whole load of pieces of music that he just dismissed, really. I mean, which ended up being basically the first Mission singles and first album. All those songs, Sacrilege, Wasteland, you know, you think of it, Serpent's Kiss, they were all songs that I wrote initially for the Second Sisters album. But Andrew always had, before he had the music, he always had the titles. So the album title was going to be, I think the album title was Left on Mission and Revenge. That was the title, I think, the working title. And one of the song titles was this Corrosion. But he hadn't written that song at that point. I don't know what he had in mind to write at that point. But obviously, once we split and we formed the Mission, and within a short year, we were actually, you know, very successful. And I contend that the mission's success, early success, was the best promotion the Sisters of Mercy could have had. You know, so he owes me one. But this Corrosion came out. It was, you know, a thinly veiled attack on me particularly, but Craig as well.
I could never understand, you know, the lyrics and what way they were a parody of your style.
I don't know. I mean,
did you hear that instantly? Oh God, he's making fun of me.
No, I didn't hear. What I heard it as, I tell you, we were actually in the studio recording the Children album, and in the video came up late one night while we were watching TV, and I was tripping on acid, and the video came on, and it was like, bloody hell, these lyrics. This is all about me, you know. And it wasn't a case of
paranoia.
No, not paranoia. It wasn't a case of paranoia. It was a case of, if that's how you feel, fine. I'll just get on with what we're doing, you know, and we'll do the best we can. Because by that point, really, we had diverged. You know, I think you could argue that, you know, the first Mission album was an extension of First and Last Norway. You could see the link between that. But by the time we came to make Children, we'd evolved into something else. We'd evolved into, you know, a rock band, a classic rock band, if you want, rather than, I hate to say, a goth band from whence we came.
Someone once told you that only music journalists and other singers care about the lyrics. And you've said on multiple occasions that you don't spend that much time on lyrics. I used to have friends in high school who would spend hours analyzing your songs, you know, finding the hidden meaning.
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, that's a certain bass player that said that to me once. And I'm still working with him. He said, don't bother about lyrics. You just write any old bollocks, you know. There's only other singers and journalists that take any notice of them. And at the time I thought, like, well, there's an element of truth in that. But I think over the years I've come to care more about I did care, but I always was of the opinion that the sound of words in a song was more important than what they meant. And what I mean by that is that the voice is just another component of the music. And so the sound of words is very important in within the music, if that makes sense. Obviously, there are people like Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen who write, you know, outstanding lyrics, and that's the focus of their art. But you listen to most pop music, you might pick out one or two lines here and there. The lyrics are not the first thing you hear, unless, you know, pop maybe the chorus might pop out or something. You know, it's the overall thing. You know, it's and the lyrics, the vocals are a part of the composition of the whole piece. I didn't care about the lyrics, but I tended to write when I was speeding. So whilst I was speeding, the lyrics would mean something to me, and then I would look at them the next day and think, I have no idea what that means, but they sound good. So, yeah, in argument to that, you could say something like Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles, or even I Am the Walrus by John Lennon wrote those lyrics to confound his fans, because they would pore over all his lyrics, and it's like, well, I'm going to write something that's gobbledygook, and, you know, let's see what you come up with here. And, there we go. Strawberry Fields is one of them.
You've borrowed a few lines from others, like Butterfly on a Wheel, your most popular song on Spotify, at least. The title comes from a poem by Alexander Pope.
Yep.
And you also quote Johnny Thunders.
Yep.
You can't put your arms around a memory in that song. I remember the first time I heard...
It's such a lovely phrase. You can't can't wrap your arms around a memory. It's such a...
I heard your song first. So when I heard the Johnny Thunders song the first time, I just assumed that he had stolen that line from The Mission.
No. How can you say? I'm a collector. I don't worry about recycling, whether it's my own stuff or somebody else's. As long as you end up putting your own character into what you do, then, you know, I mean, what's that old saying? I don't know who said it originally, Picasso or something. It's like, great artists borrow.
Geniuses steal.
Genius. That's it. Geniuses steal. Not that I'm saying I'm a genius, like previous guests of yours. but that's, you know, that's, I think Bowie was very, very like that too, as well. I mean, I think if you look at most lyricists, they borrow and they take stuff from all sources. And that's what I do. I hear, you know, lines in songs, and it might trigger another, you know, something else for me, or a line in a book, or a line in a film, or something somebody says in conversation. But, you know, yeah, it's, you could write a song about the painting that your little boy did at school, you know, and call it Strawberry Fields of Forever. Let me take you down. Actually, it was Lucy in the Sky and the Diamonds, wasn't it?
Might have been.
Yeah, well, that's all right. But this is a better song. I love this song. Misunderstanding.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
How did you create your iconic look in the 80s? I mean, you describe it as a mixture of Boy George and Clint Eastwood in the old spaghetti westerns.
Well, yeah, I also go on to explain that I wasn't as pretty as Boy George or as handsome as Clint Eastwood. I don't know. It's a mixture of, I mean, you know, the hat. You know, I started wearing the hat with the sisters.
Yeah, the bolero hat.
Yeah, I mean, the very practical reason why I started wearing the hat in the first place on tour was because Gary Marks was sick on my head on a journey to Boston, and they wouldn't let me in the club without all the sick in my hair. And in those days, it was all backcombed, you know, it was all up in backcombs. So it was like, you know, you're not coming in here, buddy, with your head like that. You know, it's like, oh, okay. So I had to go and buy a hat. So there was a shop across the road.
You could have just washed your hair at the hotel,
where?
Perhaps?
But he's asked for us to go and wash your hair. And I said, well, our hotel's in New York.
Oh.
You know, we were going back to New York after the show. So that wasn't practical. He wouldn't let me in to wash my hair in the venue. Anyway, so that's why I got the hat. I don't know. It was just something that developed over time. You know, it was a strange thing once the Mission started having chart hits and things, and a very young audience started coming to see us. I would look out and there'd be a lot of Wayne Hussey lookalikes in the audience. That was, you know, with the dark glasses and the hats and the long hair and the crushed velvet and stuff. And I always felt like, I suppose, I had to be one step ahead of them. That's a fashion thing, you know. I mean, I don't know. It was just a time. I mean, I look back at it now and I think, what the hell was I wearing? But then, you'd look back at most people in the 80s and think, what the hell were you wearing?
You had lipstick on as well.
Yeah.
And also like a beauty spot like Madonna used to have.
Yeah. That started off as a beauty spot and then it ended up turning into a love heart. Love her. I don't know how that happened.
You went to see Madonna once, I think, with Joey Ramone.
Well, not,
you were sitting
not,
next
not
to him.
Not with Joey Ramone. I went with Eldridge, actually. We were in New York City and Madonna was on the same label as us. So we managed to finagle tickets to go and see at Radio City Music Hall. I think it was her first tour, actually. And so me and Eldridge went, you know, they sent us a limo and all the rest of it. It was like, ooh, so we got in the limo. This is one of the things I would say about Andrew is that we actually, whilst we had our tensions, he and I shared a love for good pop music that maybe Craig and Gary Marx didn't. You know, I like Madonna. We loved "Careless Whisper" by George Michael. We loved, you know, good pop music, and so we went to see Madonna, and we ended up going into the venue, Radio City Music Hall, and there was all these little Madonna young lookalikes, teenage girls, you know, and it was pretty crazy, you know, really. It was when she was just taken off, and. And we went to our seats and there sat next to us was Joey Ramone and his girlfriend or his wife or something. And it was just like, we're just looking around. It's just the four of us sat there and all surrounded by all these nubile teenagers all dressed up as Madonna. It was great. I really enjoyed the show. It was great. It was so much fun.
So it was basically the love for pop music that made the sisters cover ABBA's Gimme Gimme, which incidentally you covered last night in Stockholm.
Well, you know what? Because we were in ABBA country. You know, I mean, actually, I have a confession that those guitar chords are actually stolen from Gimme 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 and Man After Midnight. I mean, they're a simple chord sequence, you know, used in a lot of songs. But
which of your songs was that?
Evangeline,
right.
Yeah. But there's a bit in the middle where it breaks down and I go into the basically what the chords were in Gimme 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 A Man After Me. Yeah, we did it with the sisters. We didn't do it for very long. I think it was a joke. We did it on an American tour. I think I said this in the book, actually. We did it on an American tour because our audience, Americans don't tend to do irony very well. And they didn't see the irony of what we were doing with an ABBA song. So they were all a bit nonplussed. And we loved Andrew more than anybody else. He loved being a contrarian and confusing his audience. And so doing that song to a room full of what you would call goths was quite funny. In Europe, it didn't work so well because ABBA were a lot more highly regarded here, you know, in Europe and Britain. And plus, you know, Europeans, you know, they understand irony.
Speaking of irony, last night you told the audience that you had had some Botox injections. was that a joke? Or
it's a joke. Okay. Don't look at me. I mean, the thing is,
you look smooth like a peach. God.
Well, I live in Brazil. We live a good life. We live a sensible life.
Do you smoke anymore?
I don't ordinarily. I started the tour not smoking. At home, I don't smoke. But I have, there was an occasion when we were playing in Budapest like 10 days ago, and we were playing on a boat, and the backstage area was cabins, and then there was an outside deck part of the backstage area that overlooked the Danube. And we just played a really good show, and Simon and Alex were out there smoking. I thought, go on, give me one. And it was just a moment that just, you know, smoking while you're on the Danube after having a really good show and watching the water and the lights. And it was just a cigarette moment. I must confess I've had one or two since, you know, but only after show. I must confess I like smoking. I just know it's not very good for me and it stinks, you know. I mean, when I'm not smoking and I walk past somebody in the street who smokes, it's like, ugh. So, you know. But, you know, on tour, after a show, because I'm not drinking now, I feel like I can concede to another vice that I've given up.
Even though you're straight, there's a lot of male kissing in your books. Or snogging, as you call it in the UK.
Yeah.
I know that Liam Gallagher was nervous when he met you the first time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that first words out of his mouth. Don't you fucking snog me, Aussie. yeah, I know. Kissing, it's sexual to me. It's a sign of affection. You know, back in the day, yeah, I used to like to have a snog, but it's a little bit more socially unacceptable to go up and stick your tongue in some stranger's throat these days, which is fine and fair enough. You should never go where it's not invited anyway. But back then, you know, we were young and foolhardy, and how can I say straight? I don't consider that being straight or gay, or I just consider it as being, you know, affectionate behavior. And I've got a lot of people that I feel affectionate about. I don't snog them all. In fact, the only person I do snog these days is my wife, if she lets me.
You did, however, put yourself in some kind of danger when you snogged Simon Hinkler, your guitarist, in the clubhouse for the Hells Angels in New Orleans at one point.
Yeah, well, I think we were lucky to get out of there alive, to be honest.
What happened exactly?
Well, Mick, our old drummer, was friends, a lot of his friends in the UK were Hells Angels. And he would quite often go to the clubhouses, particularly in Nottingham. And that they're all connected, you know, the Hells Angels throughout the world. They kind of have this kind of network of keeping in touch with each gang.
Chapter.
Right? Each chapter, that's right, each chapter. And so when we got to New Orleans, they came along to the show and they invited us down to the clubhouse, you know, after the show. And which is a privilege in itself, actually. The Hells Angels are quite secretive about their clubhouses very often. But anyway, me and Simon had both done acid, dropped acid, and there was a cage on the dance floor that was obviously there for, you know, girls to go and gyrate and do their thing. So me and Simon got in the cage and decided to enact being two homosexuals, and which didn't go down very well. So Mick had to kind of say, they're just tits, they're off, you know, they're just leave them alone. I'll get rid of them, I'll get them out. So he managed to persuade them to let us go without, you know, duffing us up. I mean, it's not the behaviour but to behave like that in a Hell's Angels club. But we got away with it. I wouldn't do it again.
Maybe it was even more dangerous when you went on a car ride in New York, tripping on acid with your friend Brian Brain Damage. That's even having a friend called Brian Brain Damage sounds a bit dangerous.
Well, that's it.
Something with a name.
He wasn't christened that, you know. It wasn't christened Brian Brain Damage. I mean, he was Brian, and he was a boyfriend of a friend of ours, and he used to come to the gigs, and he used to get us our drugs in America, in New York, in the New York area, because speed was our drug of choice, but it was very difficult to get over there, the kind of speed that we like. But he could. Anyway, he was called Brian Brain Damage. He became Brian Brain Damage after this car ride. And I think we were having a party. We had a night off. We were having a party in one of the hotel rooms, and we ran out of drugs. And so we wanted some more. So Brian said, "Oh, I've got a car, and so we're going to get some." And I said, "I'll come with you." So we strapped ourselves in the front seat, and we got in the car. I mean, really, I think about it now, we could have caused such horrific damage, not just to ourselves, but to other people. And it's one of those occasions I think, hell, how the hell did we get away with that? But basically, I dared him to just put his foot down and drive straight down one of those long avenues that you have in New York, not stopping at any red lights or anything. And we did it. And there were cars going, ee, bee, bee.
That's insane.
It was insane. It was absolutely insane. And we really, I can't say I regret it, because in the end, ultimately, no damage was done either to ourselves or to anyone else. But it could have been catastrophic. And the worst thing about it is not that we could have hurt ourselves or killed ourselves, is what would be that we would have hurt someone else, or, you know, or worse. That was, thinking about it now, it's like, my God, you know, how do we not even get stopped?
Driving while on acid is not to be encouraged.
No, never. I mean, driving while you're on any drug really is not to be encouraged. It's not necessarily for your own safety. It's for the safety of others.
I was also surprised by the amount of sex you seem to have had while on acid. Because, you know, acid makes you more interested in carpet patterns or neon lights than female flesh.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, you do get involved with carpet patterns. And but also, sex can be something that lasts for hours and be really slow and really, you know, you're really fascinated, find fascinating the whole process. I don't know. I've had a lot of sex on acid, and it's largely been beautiful. Beautiful. I mean, you know, I know some people take acid for the quest, the enlightenment, and like it's like ayahuasca and stuff like that. But I've always taken drugs to really just have a nice time, to get off and have a nice time. You know, and I mean, I do equate drug taking really with sex. I shouldn't maybe say this, but perhaps the best sex I've ever had in my life has always been on drugs.
Another sexually interesting episode in your latest book is when you go home with a girl that you've met in a club, and on the way back to her apartment, you stop the taxi at a newsagent, and she runs out to buy cigarettes, and she comes back with a couple of soft porn magazines that feature her.
Yeah, that was a unique experience. I mean, at the time, you got to remember, this is all before social media, and you know, social media now I find a complete minefield. I mean, I you know, I have some obviously some younger nephews, and the youngest being 12 and 14, and I think what they're capably being exposed to now is something that we would just fry our brains when we were teenagers, you know. And you know, soft porn magazines, they basically were just, you know, pictures of naked women, and not particularly graphic, you know, certainly the high street stuff in Britain. But yeah, she stopped the car, we got some cigarettes, she came back with a couple of magazines, and then she was saying, "Yeah, I'm in this one this month, and then I'm in this one as well." It was like, wow. Okay, and then It seems quite tame, I think, compared to a lot of what goes on these days. You know, people sending pictures of their anatomy to strangers. I don't know. I mean, that I find that bizarre. But yeah, I mean, she basically made me look at the pictures, look at the photographs of while we were doing the deed. It was like, don't look at me, look at the photographs. It's like,
yeah, she said, according to your book, I want you to shag me while looking at these photos of me. Capiche?
Yeah.
It all feels kind of modern.
Does it?
Yes, you know, because these days people are so connected to their phones. It's almost as if the image that they project of themselves online
is
more important than the way they look in real life. So her doing that, you know, asking you to look at the pictures of her in the magazine, not on her, is reminiscent of what happens now.
Maybe you're right. I put it down to just her being a bit pervy and just being proud of being in the magazines, you know. Today's social media with all the filters and all the enhancements that you can make on photographs, nothing's real. You look at photographs, very few of them are real. You know, I mean, when I post up photographs, I don't do any of that bollocks, you know. It's just, this is how I look, you know. And
yeah, but you look really good. You know,
well, some might argue otherwise.
But, you know, the equivalent of...
Yeah, but what the point I'm making, when I see a lot of these photographs that have been enhanced, they look plastic. They look like cartoons. They look like dolls. You know, I don't mean just women. I mean men too. They don't look real.
Maybe the equivalent of Hirsch, you know, asking you to look at those pictures while you had sex would be you having sex to your own music. Have you ever done that?
Oh, no, impossible. Impossible. It's like, it really is impossible. I mean, to be totally frank, I find it hard having sex to music that I... How can I say this? That I like, because I end up concentrating on the music. So it's better to have music on that I don't know. Or music that, like, I don't know, ambient music or something like that, you know, or classical music. But if it's you know, something, oh, I like this song, it's like, dupe, you know.
And if it's your own songs, that wouldn't work.
No, my own songs, absolutely not. No. Absolutely not. But it's not just my own songs. It's song, you know, it's, you know, if you put on, I don't know, if you put on Susie and the Banshees, and I'll be going, oh, I love this guitar part. Oh, sorry. the drums in this bit are great. And there we go. Susie and the Banshees. I met up with Budgie, actually, the other night in Berlin, my old friend, and we worked it out that we've known each other for 45 years. And he's one of my favourite all-time drummers. And this one, Spellbound, the drums are immense.
You were born in 1958,
oh,
like
yes.
The three biggest pop stars of the 80s, perhaps of all time, Michael Jackson, Prince and Madonna.
And Wayne Hussey.
And Wayne Hussey, yes. So you turn 65 next week.
Yeah, next Friday.
Which
yeah,
is kind of the retirement age in a lot of countries.
Yeah, no, in the UK it's 66 actually now. I mean, I got to wait another year before I start getting my pension. I don't intend to retire. I love making music. What I find difficult is, I love playing the shows, but what I find difficult is all the stuff that comes with the touring, the travel, the lack of eating properly, the lack of sleeping properly. I mean, you know, I mentioned before that I suffer a little bit from insomnia on tour. And so I usually take a little cocktail of medicines before I go to bed, prescribed, not illegal. And I think I overdid it a little bit last night because I usually take half, and then there was half left on my bedside table. And when I woke up this morning, it was gone. So it was like, maybe I did that in the middle of the night without thinking about it, because I woke up very dopey this morning. And I'm usually not that dopey.
Do you worry about growing old?
I used to. When I hit 50, 50 was a tough age actually to come to terms with. I think when I was younger, it was always, you know, when I hit 30, not 30, but when I hit 36, and then you get rounded up to 40, and then when I hit 46, you get rounded up to 50. But 50, when I hit 50, was a tough one to deal with, and I actually spiraled a little bit and was put on antidepressants for a little while, not for long, but just kind of get me out of the funk. But when I hit 60, it was like, yes, I've made it. And since being 60, it's been really great. You know, it feels great to be alive. I mean, touch wood, I've still got, you know, health. And while other people my age and younger are no longer with us, sadly. I've lost a good friend yesterday, Andy Rourke, who used to play with the Smiths.
What do you think happens when you die?
I was raised to believe that there was an afterlife, and, you know, you go to the celestial kingdom and all that stuff. But the pragmatist in me thinks once we die, that's it. You know, I think that's it. I think when I was younger, I was more sure of what happened and more optimistic about what happened. But as I've gotten older, I know less and less, and it doesn't bother me. You know, it really doesn't bother me. I mean, my attitude is, you know, live life as full as you can. Enjoy what you do. Enjoy the people you're with, and you know, enjoy it as much as you can, because you never know what's around the corner.
You probably go to heaven, at least according to South Park. Did you see that episode when they show how thousands of people arrive in hell? And this man says, but this must be a mistake. I've been a devout Catholic my entire life. And this other dude goes, but I'm a rabbi. I went to the synagogue for every single day my entire life. What am I doing here? And the receptionist goes, oh, let's see here. Oh, I'm sorry, but you picked the wrong religion. The Mormons was the right answer. Yes, the Mormons. So it turns out everyone else goes to hell except for the Mormons.
I think that is actually a concept of the Mormon faith, which is a bit ism. I don't know what kind of ism that is, but it is an ism. I think... heaven and hell, I don't know. I like to think that whatever somebody believes in, that's what happens to them. Like, my mum and dad are devout Mormons, and they believe in all of this, and I like to think that, you know, the afterlife for them will be what they expect it to be. My wife is, she's on a spiritual quest, you know, and she has all these, searching for answers. As I say, she's 18 years younger than me, but I'm kind of really okay with where I am and what I am and what I do, and I have no answers, and I'm not particularly that bothered. I'm quite happy not knowing, you know, to be totally frank. If it is that Mormons get into heaven, then I might be a borderline case, I think. I'm still a baptized Mormon, because they can only excommunicate you from the church if you're active. And I've not been an active Mormon since I was, you know, 17, 18 years old. So they can't excommunicate me for all the things that I've done wrong in the eyes of the church, because I've not been active. So I might even still get to that celestial kingdom. One of my main influences is a guitar player. And I would say I have three main influences. One being Jimmy Page. The other being John McGeoch. And the primary, I would say, would be Tom Verlaine and Television. The first two Television albums I absolutely adore. I had the privilege of meeting Tom briefly when he was in Brazil about 10 years ago. He came down for an acoustic show, which was marvellous. I mean, even playing on acoustic guitar, he could get that special tone vibrato that he gets when he plays guitar. I absolutely loved Television and Frictions off of Mark Noon, which is one of the all-time greats.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I've got a couple of questions from my listeners.
Oh dear.
And not just any listeners. I'm talking about the gentle souls who support this podcast through Patreon. Thank you for doing that. I love you all. The first question is from Albin Ydrefelt. Is the song Amelia based on a real incident?
Yes. Yes. I've told this story many times before. When, 1989, I guess, when I wrote the song, we used to receive fan mail. We used to have an office that was like a fan club. And I received a letter that was anonymous, sent anonymously. And it was a young girl. And she was writing that she was being sexually abused by her father, and she didn't know what to do, or she didn't know who to turn to, or anything like that. And there was no name, and there was no return address, and I just felt compelled to try and do something for her. I basically wrote the song, and I know there's a lot of people, it makes people feel uncomfortable, but that's the idea, you know, and that's also the reason I put it first track on the album. You can't hide something like that away. It's fourth track on side two.
And it's a song about incest and rape, basically.
It's about a father, raping his daughter. And, you know, it's blunt, and I know it makes people feel uncomfortable, and so it should. It makes me feel uncomfortable to sing it, even now. It makes me angry, and so that's why I don't play it very often, because I don't like being angry on stage needlessly. mostly when I sing songs these days, I don't actually think of what I'm singing anymore. I actually think more about just singing it in tune and playing the guitar parts. But with Amelia, there are definitely times when I played it and I've really felt the lyrics again, really thought about the lyrics again. And, you know, it puts me in a bad mood for another two or three songs afterwards. So it's not that comfortable for me either. Saying that though, the girl who wrote me the letter, she in the last 10 years she came to a show. She revealed herself to me and said that after that song she left home. She left home, you know, 15, 16 years old, got away from her father, and she obviously had emotional problems during her life, but you know, she's a mother of two children. She went into a marriage that was abusive. I guess that's just the trend that happens once you've been in that situation. But she ended that marriage, and now she's got the two children, and she's as happy, I guess, as she could be. So I think in that respect, the song did what I wanted it to do, which was to give her specifically some kind of recognition that somebody's listening.
The second question is from Matthias Forslund, who writes, I had a backstage pass and met the Mission after the show in Solnahallen in Stockholm in 1988. They were super nice, but Wayne was passed out in the shower. It's a miracle that he could perform. Did drugs make him more creative, or was it just something that he fooled around with on tour?
I wasn't fooling around with on tour. I mean, back in the day, drugs were a part of our everyday life, and it was painful when we went to places where we couldn't get drugs, like Japan, as a total no drug tolerance there. So we went to Japan. It was like, we can't get anything. It's like, well, just give me some aspirin then, please. I'll just give you something, you know. So it wasn't a case of being creative. I mean, I used to write most of the lyrics while I was speeding in the first two or three albums. That helped me in a creative way. But as I said earlier, I mean, I would write stuff and think, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And then the next day it would be just gibberish. But it's okay. Something like Naked and Savage, for instance, I still, to this day, haven't worked out what that song's about. You know, and that's what, 40 years or whatever, 35, I don't know, long time ago. In the studio, when we were younger, using speed was conducive to being creative, because you would be in a fury of getting things done. You know, you would want to get things done. There wouldn't be any messing about. It would be, you know, let's work 18-hour days. And so, you know, we would get a lot done. I think acid is pretty impossible to do anything on creatively. I mean, you could try, but I'm sure you're not in control at all. Smoking spliff, for that, some people that works. For me, it never did in the studio. It made me lethargic and, you know, just want to sit back and listen rather than play. I don't know. I mean, it's everybody's different, you know. They react differently to different drugs, and some people can create brilliant music while they're stoned, and I'm sure some people have written brilliant songs while they're tripping, you know. I mean, Syd Barrett is a perfect example of somebody that wrote fantastic lyrics, and he was, you know, supposedly, you know, an acid freak. So who knows? Each to their own, I guess.
I'm seeing Depeche Mode here in Stockholm live in a few days.
Lucky you. My friend works for them, actually.
Really?
Well, Martin Gore is a friend of mine as well, but yeah.
Martin Gore lent backing vocals to your latest Mission album.
Yeah, he also did we did a version of Tower of Strength a couple of years ago for charity when COVID first came in, and he was one of the ones that lent his voice and also put some synth on the track. I mean, basically, I got Budgie from the Banshees, Kevin Haskins from Bauhaus doing the drums, Andy Rourke played the bass, and I got Richard Fortus from Guns N' Roses, Robin Fink from Nine Inch Nails, Billy Duffy from The Cult, a couple of other guitar players, I can't remember now, and a whole host of friends singing. And we released it for charity. And Martin was one of the voices, yeah, that helped on that. And but he's been a long-time friend. So
I saw this amazing picture of you two from 1991 where you had this glam rock cover band supergroup called The Sexiest Boys.
Yeah.
How did that thing come about?
Well, as I said, we... in 1990, we released Carved in Sand around the same time as Depeche released Violator. And so we ended up doing a few TV shows together in Europe, and one in particular was in Italy. I've forgotten, it was the song festival there that met the big one. Anyway, we ended up being in the same dress room and all singing glam rock songs together there, Martin playing guitar. And then after the show, ended up partying with them and staying up all night with Dave and Alan. And then I think the next year, it was Martin's 30th birthday. Him and Fletch actually had birthdays very close to each other. And they wanted to throw a party at Martin's house out in the countryside outside of London. And they wanted to put a glam rock group together. And they knew that we'd done the Metal Gurus thing, which was a glam rock pseudonym thing that we did. We went out and just played glam rock songs for fun a couple of times. And so they asked me if I would go and sing. So that's how we became friends. And we played at Martin's party in his garden. And we were called the Sexiest Boys. It was nothing to do with me being the name, but... Yeah, it was good. It was great fun.
You didn't go on tour, though?
No. It's just a party in Martin's big garden. You know, he had a marquee up, and you know, loads of people came, and it was fun. We did all glam rock cover versions, and we dressed up, you know, glam rock.
You and him have another thing in common. Both your fathers, your biological fathers, were American soldiers stationed in England.
Mm-hmm.
And you found out that the man you thought was your father wasn't when you were like 8 or 9, I think.
About 11, actually.
And
I mean, it, in retrospect, I don't think my mum and dad ever hid it from me.
No.
But it's just something you never really realise or question when you're 5, 6, 7 years old. It was only when somebody at 11, when I was 11, somebody at church said, "Oh, so when did you find out you were adopted?" And it's like, "I'm not adopted." And it was like, "Oh." And then it was obviously, I broke down in tears, and my mum and dad got called, and they explained the situation to me then. And it's like, okay. Yeah, no, I mean, it was traumatic. But the thing is, I've never really had any interest in finding out who my paternal father was. I mean, all I know that he was a serviceman. He was from LA. His name was Tony. My dad is my dad. I call him my adoptive dad, but he's my dad. He's always been my dad, you know, as long as I can remember. But funnily enough, just 18 months ago, I received an email from one of my daughters who'd done a DNA test a couple of years ago. She was given a DNA test, one of those genealogy things, you know. And somebody had got in touch with her and said, "I think we might be related." And then my daughter wrote to me, said, "I think you might have an older sister in England." And so she put us in touch. And I do have an older sister by the same father who, again, had a one-night stand with her mum. But she was given up for adoption totally. You know,
which so you weren't.
I was going to be, but my mum changed her mind at the very last minute.
So they wanted to send you to America, right?
Well, that was the family that came over from America to take me home. And then my mum had to sign the papers on the last day, and she refused. She's, you know, it's like, no, I've changed my mind. I want to keep my boy, which I'm so thankful for, of course. I mean, you know, who knows where I might be or what I might be doing these days. But anyway, I had found my long lost sister about 18 months ago, and we've got the same dad, same paternal father. And
what's she like?
She's great. I mean, unfortunately, she looks a bit like me, but without the beard. but you can see, you can definitely see the resemblance. And she's lovely. She's great, you know. And she's
was she familiar with your music?
No. When she spoke to my daughter, said, "Oh, my dad's Wayne Hussey," and it was like, "Oh, okay, he's in the Mission." Oh, all right. It was. She had no idea. I mean, but you know, now she did some Googling and stuff, and you know, now she's a proud big sister. You know, she's been to see us and stuff.
How old are your daughters?
One was born in 94, so she's 29, and the other was born in 87. Sorry, so that makes her 36. 36, yeah. I'm a granddad two times over.
Really?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, I don't know if it is, but yeah.
But do you keep in touch, even though you live in Sao Paulo?
Yeah, I keep in touch with my daughter in LA. I'm sadly estranged from my daughter in Leeds, but that's another story for another time. I'm going to have to get going, actually, because we have another show tonight, and I need to rest the voice. I've been talking too much today, and I've got to get put my wig on for tonight. No, I've got to wash my hair and do things like that, you know, to look the rock star a bit.
Inject some Botox.
No.
Thank you ever so much for coming here, Wayne. It was a true honor.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor for me. You are a legend in certain quarters, I believe.
Wow.
Okay, you're speechless right now, aren't you?
I'm completely speechless. I don't know what to say. Let's just stop this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Lejon Media. Wayne Hussey var hemma hos Dragen.